My guest is Maricha Sharka. Maricha Sharka is a fellow at Stanford University's Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence and the Cyber Policy Center. She's also the author of a new book, The Tech Coup: How to Save Democracy from Silicon Valley. Welcome to the podcast, Maricha.
Thanks, Paul.
Well, you may remember, I hope you do remember, we did one of these podcast conversations just over 5 years ago as you were stepping down from the European Parliament. And I was inviting you to reflect on your 10 years as an MEP. Now you've kind of started a whole new career. I was going to ask you, as my first question, what was the inspiration for the book, which is a kind of obvious question, but maybe linked to that, what was the inspiration for making this career move to Stanford, which is now culminated in the publication of this book?
Right. Well, I wouldn't have thought about going to a university, frankly, if they hadn't invited me to consider coming over. But when they did, it just seemed like the perfect step to deepen my understanding of technologies writ large, but also the whole ecosystem, the power brokers, the incentives, the values, and the politics of Silicon Valley, which is such an important hub of influence in our world, but one that is, best understood from close by. And so I went there also hoping to inspire, the next Mark Zuckerberg to think more about the rule of law and democracy through teaching. It has been an incredible opportunity to work with people there and to get to understand what drives various actors in Silicon Valley in their daily decisions.
Well, the title of your book is certainly dramatic. It's maybe intentionally provocative, how the Tech Coup, How to Save Democracy from Silicon Valley. When you started the book, did you already have a pretty clear idea of what you were going to set out to demonstrate? Or did you, as you research it, and the book is extremely well researched, did you discover things that even you didn't know about at the outset?
Well, the theme, of course, was something that accumulated for me as well, but that I thought I should really share as a systemic challenge. So the power grab, the erosion of agency on the part of democratic leaders and institutions vis-a-vis that enormous power and decision-making capabilities that is now in private tech companies' hands was something that, I witnessed over time. I wanted to share the observations that I learned from over time as these tech companies got bigger and bigger, more influential and powerful, but without the proper checks and balances. And I came to see it as a systemic problem, a threat to democracy that comes from the outsized power that companies have. And that was the reason for writing the book. So I knew what I wanted to say, went back into memory because it has a lot of anecdotes as well. Follow, for example, all the seek that companies do when they bid for licenses for data, for example, was something that I learned pretty much during the research of the book, that they hide identities when they bid for licenses, and that it's really a sort of the kind of scrutiny that I think is proper in a democracy. But by and large, I knew the case I wanted to make and just invested a lot of time in laying it out, writing it down in an accessible way, not just for policy wants. I
Right.
hope to reach a broad audience that way that can help change the equation.
Right. Well, you make the point, which is maybe deserved to be reinforced, that the state is not just the regulator, but also the client of the tech industry, right? And as you say, it has its tentacles in many directions, all over the place. So does that make any kind of oversight by government that much more problematic? Because at the end of the day, they're dependent, reliant on the services and the infrastructure that these tech companies provide.
I think it's a double-edged sword. So yes, the dependency is one of the major problems that we need to tackle. But on the other hand, the fact that governments are such major clients of tech companies gives them leverage at the same time. They can ask for more transparency. They can ask for more cybersecurity guarantees, for example. They can ask for better conditions when they buy this technology. So I know a lot of people are focused on, well, if there's a problem, should there be regulation? But I also emphasize that there should be a better use of the mechanism of public procurement, that there should be earmarked funds in the EU now after the Draghi report that will actually, loosen that dependence, create a better European and public interest alternatives, and that helps contribute to a reclaiming of the primacy of governance on the part of democratic leaders, because that's really what's being lost and risks being lost much more.
Some of your colleagues in the kind of commentariat who follow the tech industry like you do say that it's almost too late in the sense that the tech oligarchs are already in charge, and you say government should be more bold and more assertive in terms of transparency and conditions, etc. But do you have any sympathy with that? Almost like a counter argument that it's almost too late. The tech guys, and we all know who we're talking about, are already running the place.
Well, it is late. And of course, since I put the last letter to paper for the tech coup, Elon Musk has become the key advisor to Donald Trump, proposing an agenda of deregulation, so also causing rifts transatlantically. I worry a great deal, but I also think it's never too late. I mean, if we conclude that there has been too little that's been done to ensure the proper guardrails and oversight over these powerful tech companies, then a lot of common sense, low-hanging fruit steps can be taken today that will make things better. So I don't think we should be defeatist. I think we should be ambitious, self-confident, and especially democratic governments should feel that they can turn the tide and reclaim their own roles and powers.
Right. But you said elsewhere also that increasingly these companies take decisions that used to be the exclusive preserve of the state. Is that a tendency, a trend that's going to increase over time and therefore, again, make this oversight more difficult, challenging for governments?
Well, if governments allow decisions to continue to be made by companies that are ever more consequential, think about the development of critical digital infrastructure and the geopolitical implications, for example. Well, if they're just going to lean back and observe this development without taking action, then sure, it's going to get worse. But if there can be a shared conclusion that our dependence on tech, on the part of the public sector, our now dependence on a volatile United States, volatile as a partner that we were relying on since World War II, roughly speaking. If we see so many single points of failure that lead to security risks that really shouldn't be tolerated, if we see that sometimes governments share data with companies for analytics, but then end up losing the access or the ownership of that data. When we see that there is the outsourcing of accountability of governments themselves when they engage companies, these are all developments that are not contributing to healthy democratic governance. And I don't see why tech shouldn't be, met with the kind of oversight and transparency and accountability that we really find very, very common and normal in other sectors.
To what extent do you think, therefore, Maricha, it's also a question of mindset? If the tools are there, but they're not being deployed by governments, is it partially a question of mindset? I ask the question because, as you'll know much better than I, quite recently, the British Science Technology Secretary of State, Peter Kyle, said that the industry should be treated more like nation states and governments need to show a sense of humility. That's quite a deferential way of framing the relationship, isn't it?
Well, I was very critical of that statement. I really think it's a complete misunderstanding of who is in charge and what the power relationship should be. I know that even for, a progressively leaning government, they've been hiring a lot of tech people that the UK government is mainly focused, it seems, on attracting investment. So maybe this is, a way to articulate that they're going to listen more to companies. But I think that that's a bad choice, the wrong step, actually. And so I agree that it's also about appreciating the different roles that people play, that companies should, be subject to accountability the way that a company be, whether it's tech or otherwise. So it is a mindset, but it's also, I think, a challenge of not seeing problems as incidents, which there are too many of, right? Whether we look at disinformation, a hot topic again after the election in Romania, whether we look at data breaches, cybersecurity, whether we look at politics and supply chains, it is really understandable that political leaders are tempted to respond to short-term and immediate developments without stepping back and seeing the full picture of this systemic problem of power. And that's also why I wrote the book, to provide that zoomed out perspective and to connect the dots. Because I think if we appreciate the problem at the right level, then the solutions will also come from a slightly different perspective and can hopefully have a bigger systemic impact than going after different incidents that are, serious enough as they are, but that will also hinder us in finding the right solutions at the right moment.
And how successful do you think the tech sector, in broad terms, has been in establishing almost like the framework within which any kind of discussion of regulation, never mind actual regulation itself, takes place? Have they been effective in setting the terms of discussion, terms of debate, in effect?
Well, absolutely. I spent quite a bit of time in the tech coup focusing on framing, so
Right.
not just, the good old lobbying that we all know so well, having worked in Brussels, where, to some extent it's a fair game. Different stakeholders want to get their points across, and there we unfortunately see how money plays an important role in the tech sector, spending unprecedented amounts of money lobbying, also in Brussels. But they're doing more. They are funding academics. They are funding think tanks. They are funding civil society organizations and even developing them. So, setting up civil society organizations on the part of companies to steer the debate, frame the debate. And I don't know that many listeners to this podcast or readers of the book would know that. And so, I try to show the whole ecosystem of ways in which tech companies are trying to frame our understanding of technology, which helps them, of course, frame our understanding of tech policy, and also seek to create and influence the ecosystem of thinkers and regulators around it. So they have done a very sophisticated job at being influential from a variety of directions, if you will.
But are there any signs that you can identify, serious signs that, in effect, governments, both the United States but also in the European Union, are getting wise to this and are suggesting contrary initiatives to tackle or at least to challenge the primacy of the tech sector?
The primacy part focus on yet. It's sort of my mission to bring that across, that the horizontal policy lens should really be the reclaiming of that primacy lens. But if you look at the ambitions of Biden, he actually really wanted to tackle a number of issues, whether it was data protection or the role of minors and all the vulnerable ways in which they are exposed when they go online, wanted to do more vis-a-vis crypto, et cetera. But of course, had a Congress that was so divided that it couldn't pass legislation the way we did in the EU. So he had to rely on executive orders around artificial intelligence that I think remarkable from a leadership point of view on spyware, where the US said the government can no longer buy commercial spyware, which is going much further than the EU ever has. But unfortunately, because these are executive orders, we must assume that Trump will revoke them the minute he takes office. So it's clear that Biden had a better sense in any case than previous US administrations of what was at stake, but that he was hindered by the political makeup of the Congress in doing as much as he would have liked to enshrine measures in law.
You mentioned Musk now, and obviously, as you say, your book is even more timely now with this elevation, remarkable elevation of Musk as a key player in the new upcoming Trump administration. But do you think to what extent there's going to be at some point this bromance, first of all, between Trump and Musk? How long will it last? Is there any telltale sign that it's doomed to ultimately fizzle out? And secondly, linked to that, do you think some of the tech company competitors of Musk will start getting slightly alarmed if they think that this fellow traveler, but also competitor, i.e. Elon Musk, will start using his influence to the benefit of his own activities and not to theirs?
Right. Well, I agree that it's a very, remarkable relationship for Trump to bring anyone so close and not be, the alpha at the very top of the mountain. But I don't know how long this honeymoon will last. We'll have to see. And I'm pretty sure that other tech leaders are uncomfortable with, one of their peers, but one with a specific agenda, being so close to the president-elect. They are making pilgrimages to Mar-a-Lago themselves, trying to become closer to the president-elect, as we've seen with Mark Zuckerberg, for example, but also Jeff Bezos trying to rekindle a kind of friendship with Donald Trump. So I do think they're nervous. I think we're in a phase now before the inauguration where they're keeping their cards to their chest a little bit, kind of waiting and seeing, trying to use the time to establish a better rapport with the president. And I can well imagine sort of civil war between the different tech CEOs when it comes to their influence. I also know that some of them are quite concerned. Concerned for the kind of revenge attitude that some people in the MAGA camp have, vis-a-vis critics, people in the bureaucracies of the US government, you know, that fear that they will be subject to a purge. So I don't think we should just look at this as if it's some kind of a soap, you know, where we get out the popcorn and we look to when the bromance will crash. But there's really more at stake, you know, very, very fundamental freedoms of people in the United States are being challenged. People feel threatened. I think things can be getting very, very ugly, very, very fast. And we must really look at what someone like Elon Musk does and not just what he says, because we hear him saying that he doesn't want censorship, he wants freedom of expression. But at the same time, in the name of freedom of expression, critics are actually muffled and tried and brought before Congress. You know, if you look at the activities of Jim Jordan that have had a deep impact on academic freedom around disinformation research. So I really worry that things can get ugly very fast. And I also fear that Europeans are completely unprepared.
Well, you mentioned Europeans. Let's maybe finish off this chat, Marietje, by switching to the other side of the pond here in the European Union. You mentioned briefly at the beginning the Draghi report, this major contribution to the von der Leyen Commission version 2 on competitiveness and the European economy. And as you know, one of the key recommendations of the Draghi report is to question the European tendency, as he would say, to overregulate. I know that's a contestable phrase, but we, as you know, in Europe are very, very proud of the so-called Brussels effect, that we regulate for the world, until now at least. But the trend in the new commission may be reinforced by the rightward shift after the European Parliament election to have less regulation. And this debate about regulation stifling innovation has taken on a new lease of life. Do you agree with that?
Well, I do think there's been some selective reading of Draghi's report, and surely we've heard a lot of people saying, well, see, regulation stifles innovation. Now, of course, when there's overly bureaucratic rules, that's a problem. But Draghi also well recognizes that the access to capital is a big problem, for example. And there one could argue it's a lack of regulation because it's a lack of harmonization between the EU member states that makes it harder for companies to access venture capital, easier for them to go to the United States. He talks a lot about investments, which I think is incredibly important. So there is a lot that Europe needs to do. Don't get me wrong, I fully agree. But I also don't think that having a focus on innovation is the only obligation that European leaders or national leaders have. They also need to look at national security, something where the EU continues to have challenges because it's, you know, a national competence. And member states will remind the European Commission every opportunity they get that this is a national competence. And so we have tensions between how harmonized or fragmented the EU is vis-a-vis these big geopolitical challenges, this big competition game between the US and China, and then the question of the role of Europe. So I do believe a lot is at stake, but that we should not fall back into sort of a cliche approach to this tension between regulation and innovation and really do what it takes to make the European economy more competitive, but also to take measures in the short term to absorb possible shocks that can come from, you know, the changes in the White House or other geopolitical confrontations that are, you know, around every corner where we watch.
Do you have any concerns, though, that in this new mandate of the von der Leyen Commission too, that there'll be a rowing back of regulation, especially in the tech sector? As you will know, even from your MEP days, but even now, especially now, the Digital Service Act, Digital Markets Act, the AI Act, and many others are increasingly being criticized for being unwieldy and producing unintended consequences, the need for a review, all that kind of a discussion going on. Do you have concern that there may be rolling back of all that?
Well, I do have a concern of the politicizing of enforcement. So, about how stringently the rules will be enforced, especially when pressures come from the United States not to do so or to leave certain US tech companies out. I think the implementation phase still has to prove itself. It's really too early to draw any conclusions, but I do fear that there will be politicizing of that enforcement, also of antitrust cases. And so, again, here, the fact that our transatlantic relation will change in a dramatic way very, very soon is something that will inform a lot of what the EU is going to do. And I can only hope that it stays principled, true to strengthening the rule of law, strengthening the European Union, fragmentation, also in the interest of, different member states trying to get closer to the president, and rather doing that than collaborating on a European level is a real risk that's looming.
Right. Well, the final question then, Marija, what can the European Union do, either the EU itself or as individual member states? Are we destined to be a mere bit player? There are none of these big tech companies of European origin, at least for the moment, at least, and it's unlikely to change anytime soon. As I said earlier, we like to think in Europe that we can regulate companies outside our jurisdiction, and we've done that with some success until now. Maybe another way to phrase the question: what would you advise Ursula von der Leyen to focus on or to be wary of as she starts her new 5-year term?
Well, she should really focus on investing in ways that loosens that dependency. So that creates better European alternatives. People are talking about a euro stack. I think that's a really exciting opportunity to also create markets in Europe with the investments that are being made by earmarking them from a security point of view towards more European alternatives, because that dependency on foreign tech companies is not just an economic loss, it's also a risk from a security point of view. And so, to really articulate specific ways in which that strategic autonomy can take shape while investing and making sure that in the short and in the long term, Europe can be less held by the whims of others and more able to support itself and to create exciting opportunities while it does so. You're right that this is a long-term project, but we should start today. And the temptation to continue as is with the uptake of AI, for example, to continue to just transfer money to Silicon Valley is one that seems all too easy, but that would be a mistake. So I hope that the strategic stakes are clear to von der Leyen and that she will stay firm.
Right. Well, on that note, we have to leave it there. Marija Šarka, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.